Why?
And suddenly, he was back at that bullshit intervention. Lydia and his mom across the room.
We're worried, Pat.
And this has to stop, refusing to meet his eyes. Lydia had known Pat's mom first, had met her through community theater in Seattle, and unlike most of his girlfriends whose disappointment was all about the way his behavior affected them, Lydia complained on Pat's mother's behalf. How he ignored her for months at a time, until he needed money. How he broke promises to her. How he still hadn't repaid the money he'd taken.
You can't keep doing this, Lydia would say. It's killing her.
Her, in Pat's mind, really meaning both of them. To make them happy, Pat quit everything but booze and pot, and he and Lydia lurched along for another year until his mother got sick. In hindsight, though, their relationship was probably done at that intervention, the minute she stood on his mother's side of the room.
Where is she now?
Umi asked.
Your mum?
Idaho, Pat said wearily. In this little town called Sandpoint. She runs a theater group there. Then, surprising himself, she has cancer.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Umi said that her father had non-Hodgkin's lymphoma. Pat could have asked for details, as she'd done, but he'd said simply,
That's tough. Just a bit.
Umi stared at the floor.
My brother keeps saying how brave he is. Dad's so brave. He's battling so bravely. Bloody misery, actually.
Yeah. Pat felt squirmy. Well, he assumed that enough polite post-orgasm conversation had passed. At least it would have in America. He wasn't sure of the British exchange rate. Well, I guess... He stood. She watched him get dressed.
You do this a bit,
she said, not a question. I doubt more than anyone else, Pat said. She laughed.
That's what I love about you good-looking blokes. What, me? Have sex?
If London was an alien city, Edinburgh was another planet. They took the train, Joe falling asleep the minute it pulled out of King's Cross, so that Pat could only guess at the things he saw out the window. Clothesline neighborhoods, great ruins in the distance, grain fields and clusters of coastal basalt that made him think of the Columbia River Gorge back home.
Right then,
Joe said 4.5 hours later, sniffing awake and glancing around as they pulled into the Edinburgh station. They emerged from the station at the bottom of a deep draw, a castle on their left, the stone walls of a Renaissance city on their right. The Fringe Festival was bigger than Pat had expected. Every street light and pole covered with a flyer for one show or another. The streets swarming with people. Tourists, hipsters, middle-aged showgoers, and performers of every imaginable kind. Mostly comedians, but actors and musicians too. Acts in singles, pairs, and improv troupes. A whole range of mimes and puppeteers, fire jugglers, unicyclists, magicians, acrobats, and Pat didn't know what. Living statues, guys dressed like suits on hangers, breakdancing twins. A medieval festival gone freak. At the festival office, an arrogant prick with a mustache and an accent even heavier than Joe's, all lilting rhythms and rolling R's, explained that Pat was expected to provide his own marketing and that his stipend would be half what Joe had promised. Joe saying someone named Nicole had insured the rate. Mustache saying Nicole couldn't insure her own arse. Joe turning to Pat to say not to worry, he wouldn't take a commission. Pat surprised that he'd ever planned to. Outside, as they walked toward their accommodations, Pat took everything in. The city walls were like a series of cliff faces, the oldest part, the Royal Mile, leading from the castle and curling like a cobblestone stream down a canyon of smoke-stained stone edifices. The bustling noise of the festival stretched in every direction. The grand houses gutted to make way for stages and microphones, the sheer number of desperate performers sinking Pat's spirits. Pat and Joe were put up in a boarder's room below street level, in an older couple's flat.
Say something funny,
the cross-eyed husband said when he met Pat. That night, Joe led Pat to his show. Up a street, down an alley, through a crowded bar, into another alley, to a narrow, high door with an ornate knob in the middle. An uninterested woman with a clipboard led Pat to his green room, a closet of standpipes and mops, Joe explaining that crowds often started slowly but built quickly in Edinburgh. That there were dozens of influential reviewers, and once the reviews came in, "You're a bloody lock for 4 stars." The crowds would soon follow. A minute later, the woman with the clipboard announced him, and Pat came around the corner to a smattering of applause, thinking, what's less than a smattering? Because there were only 6 people in the room, scattered out among 40 folding chairs, 3 of the 6 being Joe and the old couple they were staying with. But Pat had played his share of empty rooms, and he killed in this one, even riffing a new bit before Lydia. She told our friend she discovered me with another woman. Like what, she'd discovered a cure for polio? She told people she caught me having sex, like she'd apprehended Carlos the Jackal. I mean, you could catch Bin Laden if you came home and he was fucking someone in your bed. Pat felt the thing he'd noticed before, that even the appreciation of a small crowd can be profound. He loved how British people hung on the first syllable of that word, brilliant. And he stayed up all night with an even more excited Joe, talking about ways to market the show. The next day, Joe presented Pat with posters and handbills advertising the show. Across the top was a picture of Pat holding his guitar, under the heading, "Pat Bender, I Can't Help Meself," along with the tagline, "One of America's Most Outrageous Comedy Musicians," and 4 stars from something called The Riot Police. Pat had seen such flyers for other performers at the festival, but "I Can't Help Meself"? And this "One of America's" bullshit? Every act had to put up such handbills, Joe explained. Pat didn't even like being called a comedy musician. He wasn't some Weird Al novelty act. Writers were allowed to be irreverent and still be serious, and filmmakers. But musicians were expected to be earnest shitheels. "I love you, baby," and "Peace is the answer." Fuck that. For the first time, Joe was frustrated by Pat, his pale cheeks going pink. "Look, this is just how it's done, Pat. You know who the fucking Riot Police are? Me. I gave you the 4 stars. He threw a handbill at Pat. "I paid for this whole bloody thing." Pat sighed. He knew it was a different world, a different time. Bands expected to blog and flog and twit and fuck knew what. Hell, Pat didn't even own a cell phone. Even in the States, no one got away with being a quiet, brooding artist anymore. Every musician had to be his own publicist now. Bunch of self-promoting twats posting every fart on a computer. A rebel now was some kid who spent all day making YouTube videos of himself putting Legos up his ass. "Legos in his arse," Joe laughed. "You should use that." That afternoon they went around handing out flyers on the street. At first it was as demeaning and pathetic as Pat had imagined. But he kept looking over at Joe and being humbled by the fevered energy of his young friend. "See, the act has blown him away in the States." And so Pat did his best, concentrating on the women. "You should come," he'd say, turning his eyes on, pressing a handbill into a woman's hands. "I think you'll like it." There were 18 people at his show that night, including the reviewer from something called The Laugh Track, who gave Pat 4 stars, and, Joe read excitedly, wrote on his blog that the one-time singer for the old American cult band The Reticents delivers a musical monologue that is truly something different, edgy, honest, funny. He is a genuine comic misanthrope. The next night, 29 people came, including a decent-looking girl in black stretch pants, who stuck around after the show to get stoned with him. Pat banged her against the standpipe in his green room closet. He woke with Joe across from him in a kitchen chair, already dressed, arms crossed.
"You fucked Umi."
Disoriented, Pat thought he meant the girl after the show. "You know her?"
"Back in London, you daft prick. Did you sleep with Umi?"
"Oh, yeah," Pat sat up. "Does Curtis know?"
"Curtis? She told me. She asked if you'd mentioned her."
Joe tore off his glasses and wiped his eyes.
"Do you remember, after you sang Lydia in Portland, I said I was in love with my best mate's girl, Umi. Remember?"
Pat did recall Joe talking about someone, and now that he mentioned it, the name did sound familiar. But he was so excited by the prospect of a UK tour that he hadn't really been listening.
"Curtis bunks every bird in the East End, just like the daft prick in your song. And I haven't told Umi a fucking thing about it because Kurt's me mate. And the first chance you get..."
His face went from pink to red and his eyes welled.
"I love that girl, Pat."
"Joe, I'm sorry. I had no idea you felt that way."
"Who did you think I was talking about?"
Joe snapped his glasses back on and stalked out of the room. Pat sat there a while, feeling genuinely awful. Then he dressed and went out in the packed streets to look for Joe. "What had he said? Like the daft prick in your song?" Jesus, did Joe think that song was some kind of parody? Then he had a horrible thought. Christ, was it? Was he? All afternoon, Pat looked for Joe. He even tried the castle, which buzzed with camera-snapping tourists, but no Joe. He wandered back down into Newtown, to the top of Calton Hill, a gentle crest covered with incongruent monuments from different periods in Edinburgh's past. The city's entire history was an attempt to get a better vantage, a piece of high ground on which to build higher, spires and towers and columns, all of them with narrow spiral staircases to the top. And Pat suddenly saw humanity the same way. It was all this scramble to get higher, to see enemies and lord it over peasants, sure, but maybe more than that, to build something, to leave a trace of yourself, to have people see that you were once up there, on stage. And yet what was the point, really? Those people were gone. Nothing left but the crumbling rubble of failures and unknowns. 40 people at the show that night, his first sellout. But no Joe. "I walked around Edinburgh today and decided that the whole of art and architecture is just some dogs pissing on trees," Pat said. It was early in the show and he was wandering dangerously off script. "My whole life, I've assumed I was supposed to be famous, that I was supposed to be big. What is that? Fame?" He leaned over his guitar, looking out on the expectant faces, hoping, along with them, that this was about to get funny. "The whole world is sick. We've all got this pathetic need to be seen. We're a bunch of fucking toddlers trying to get attention, and I'm the worst. If life had a theme, you know, a philosophy, a motto, mine would be, there must be some mistake. I was supposed to be bigger than this." Where did shit shows come from? Pat had no way of knowing if he suffered more bombs than other performers, but shit shows had always come regularly for him. With the Reticents, the consensus was that they'd put out one great album, the Reticents, one good one, Mana, and one pretentious, unlistenable mess, Metronome. And they had a reputation for being unpredictable live, although this was intentional, or at least unavoidable, with him coked up for a few years there, Benny banging smack, and Casey Millar doing a drummer's fifth at gigs. How could they not be uneven? But nobody wanted even. The whole point was to put some edge back in the thing. No synth dance mixes, no big hair, no fey makeup, no poser flannel faux angst bullshit. And if the Reticents had never succeeded beyond cult club status, they also never became slick self-promoting power ballad playing pretenders either. They stayed true, as people used to say, back when staying true meant something. But even with the Rets, sometimes, He'd just have a shit show. Not because of drugs or fighting or experimenting with feedback. Sometimes it just sucked. And that's what happened the day he got in a fight with Joe, and the night the reviewer from The Scotsman came to see Pat Bender, I Can't Help Meself. Pat blew the setup for Wire Drummer So Ducking Fum, and then tried to get out of it with some lame 80s comic patter about how it's called Scotch in America, but just whiskey in Scotland. Was Scotch tape just tape? People staring at him like, yeah, bloody right, it's tape, you simple shit. And he could barely get through Lydia, imagining everyone saw through him, that everyone but him understood the song. He felt that odd transference, in which an audience, normally rooting for him to be funny and moving, all of us in this together, started to resent his awkwardness. An untested, apparently unfunny bit about the big asses of Scottish girls. Like sacks of haggis, these girls are. Haggis mules smuggling heart liver sausage in their pants. Didn't help. Even his guitar sounded shrill to Pat's ear. Next morning, there was still no sign of Joe. The couple putting Pat up left the Scotsman outside his door, open to his one-star review. He read the words crass, rambling, and angry, and put the paper down. That night, 8 people came to his show. After that, things went about the way he imagined. 5 people the next night. Still no Joe. Mustache stopped by the stage to tell Pat his weekly contract wasn't being renewed. A ventriloquist would get his theater, his slot, and his boarder's room. Pat's manager had been given his check, Mustache said. Pat actually laughed at this, imagining Joe on his way to London with Pat's 500 quid. So how am I supposed to get home? Pat asked the man with the mustache. To the States? The guy asked through his nose. I don't know. Does your guitar float? The only good thing Pat had gleaned from his dark period was some knowledge about how to survive on the streets. He'd never done more than a few weeks at a time, but he felt oddly calm about what to do. There were several strata of performers in Edinburgh. Big acts, smaller paid pros like Pat, hobby guys, and up-and-comers playing what they called free fringe. And finally, below that, and just above beggars and pickpockets, a whole range of buskers, street performers, Jamaican dancers in dirty sneakers and ratty dreadlocks, Chilean street bands, magicians carrying 5 tricks in a backpack, a gypsy woman playing a strange flute, and that afternoon, on a street in front of a Costa coffee house, Pat Bender, ad-libbing funny lines to American classics. Desperado, you'd better come to your senses. With a pound and 20 pences, you ain't never getting home. There were enough American tourists that before he knew it, he had 35 pounds. He bought a half pint and some fried fish, then went to the train station, but was stunned to find the cheapest last-minute ticket to London was 60 pounds. Minus food, it might take him 3 days to raise that much. Beneath the castle was a long, narrow park, the city walls on either side. Pat walked the length of the park, looking for a place to sleep, but after an hour he decided he was too old to sleep outside with the street kids and went into Newtown, bought a pint of vodka, and paid a night hotel clerk 5 pounds to let him sleep in a toilet stall. Next morning he returned to the coffee house and resumed playing. He was doing the old Rhett song Gravy Boat just to prove to himself that he existed. When he looked up to see the girl he'd had sex with against the standpipe in his green room. The girl's eyes widened, and she grabbed her friend by the arms. Hey, that's him! She turned out to be named Naomi, to be only 18, to be vacationing from Manchester, and to be here with her parents, Claude and June, who turned out to be eating in a nearby pub, to be about his age, and to be less than thrilled to meet their daughter's new friend. Naomi almost cried as she told her parents of Pat's troubles, how he'd been ever so nice, how he'd been ripped off by his manager and stranded here with no way of getting home. 2 hours later, he was on a train to London, paid for by a father whose true motivation behind helping Pat get out of Scotland was never in doubt. On the train, Pat kept thinking about Edinburgh, about all those desperate entertainers giving out handbills in the streets, about the buskers and spires and churches and castles and cliffs, the scramble to get higher, to be seen, the cycle of creation and rebellion. Everyone assuming they were saying something new or doing something new, something profound, when the truth was that it had all been done a million billion times. It was all he'd ever wanted. To be big. To matter. Yeah, well, he could imagine Lydia saying, "You don't get to." Curtis answered the door, iPod earbuds plugged into the holes in his round, dented head. When he saw Pat, his face didn't change, or at least that's what struck Pat when Curtis shoved him back into the hallway and pinned him against the wall. Pat dropped his pack and guitar and, "Wait!" Curtis's forearm smashed into Pat's neck, cutting off his breath, a knee coming up into Pat's groin. "Bouncer tricks," Pat recognized, until a wide fist mashed his face and knocked even that thought from his head. And Pat slid off the wall to the ground. From the floor, he tried to find his breath, got his hand to his bloodied face, and managed to look between Curtis's legs for Umi or Joe. But the apartment behind Curtis seemed not only empty, but trashed. He imagined the blowout that must have done it. Joe bursting in, all the shit between the three of them finally coming out, Joe telling a stricken Umi that he loved her. He liked imagining Joe and Umi on a train somewhere, the tickets paid for with Pat's £500. Then he noticed Curtis was in his underwear. Jesus, these people. Curtis stood above him, panting. He kicked the guitar case, Pat thinking, "Please, not my guitar." "You fucking cunt," Curtis finally said. "You stupid fucking cunt." And he went back inside. Even the air from the slammed door hurt Pat. It took a few seconds for Pat to get up, and he did so only because he was worried that Curtis would come back for the guitar. On the street, people gave him a wide berth, wary of the blood burbling from Pat's nose. At a pub a block away, Pat got a pint, a bar rag, and some ice, cleaned himself in the bathroom, and watched the door of Curtis's flat. But after 2 hours, he didn't see anyone. No Joe, no Umi, no Curtis. When his beer was gone, Pat pulled the rest of his money from his pocket and laid it on the table. £12.40. He stared at his sad pile of money until his eyes were bleary, and he put his face in his hands, and Pat Bender wept. He felt cleansed somehow, as if he could finally see how this thing he'd identified in Edinburgh, this desperate hunger to get higher, had nearly destroyed him. He felt as if he'd come through some tunnel, made a final passage through the darkness to the other side. He was done with all that now. He was ready to stop trying to matter. He was ready to simply live. Pat was shaking as he stepped outside into a cool gust, driven with a resolve that bordered on despair. He slipped into the red phone booth outside the pub. It smelled like piss and was papered with faded handbills from rough strip shows and tranny escort services. "Sandpoint, Idaho, USA," he told the operator, voice cracking, and he worried that he'd forgotten the number. But as soon as he said the area code, 208, it came to him. £4.50, the operator said, almost half his money. But Pat knew that this could not be a collect call. Not this time. He put the money in. She answered on the second ring. "Hello?" But something was wrong. It wasn't his mother. And Pat thought in horror. It's too late. She had died. The house had sold. Christ,
He'd come around too late. Missed saying goodbye to the one person who had ever cared about him. Pat Bender stood bleeding and weeping alone in a red phone booth on a busy street in South London. "Hello?" the woman said again, her voice more familiar this time, though still not his mother's. "Is someone there?" "Hello?" Pat caught his breath, wiped his eyes. Is that Lydia? Pat? "Yeah, it's me." He closed his eyes and saw her, ridges of high cheek and those dark, bemused eyes beneath her short brown hair, and it felt like a sign. "What are you doing there, Lydia?" She told him that his mother was undergoing another round of chemo. God, then he wasn't too late. Pat covered his mouth. A few of them were taking turns helping out, Lydia said. First, her sisters, Pat's wretched aunts, Diane and Darlene, and now Lydia, in from Seattle for a few days. Her voice sounded so clear and intelligent. No wonder he had fallen in love with her. She was crystalline. "Where are you, Pat?"
"You won't believe it," Pat said.
He was in London, of all places. He'd been talked into doing a UK tour by this kid. But he had some trouble. The kid had ripped him off, and... Pat could sense the quiet from her end.
"No, Lydia," he said, and he laughed. He could imagine how the call must seem from her point of view. How many such calls had she taken from him? And his mom, how many times had she bailed him out? "It's different this time."
But then he stopped. Different? How? This time... what? He looked around the phone booth. What could he say that he hadn't said? What higher ground could he possibly scramble to? "This time, if I promise to never get high, drunk, cheat, steal, can I please come home?" He'd probably said that too, or would, in a week or a month, or whenever this thing came back, and it would come back, the need to matter, to be big, to get higher, to get high. And why shouldn't it come back? What else was there? Failures and unknowns. Then Pat laughed. He laughed because he saw this phone call was just another shit show in a long line of them, like the rest of his shit show life, like the shit show intervention of Lydia and his mom, which he'd hated so much because they didn't really mean it. They didn't understand that the whole fucking thing was meaningless unless you were truly prepared to cut the person loose. This time. On the other end of the phone, Lydia misread the laugh. "Oh, Pat," she spoke in little more than a whisper. "What are you on?" He tried to answer, "Nothing." But there was no air to form words. And that's when Pat heard his mother come into the room behind Lydia, her voice faint and pained. "Who is it, dear?" And Pat realized that in Idaho, it was 3 in the morning. At 3 in the morning, he'd called his dying mother to ask her to bail him out of trouble again. Even at the end of her life, she had to suffer this middle-aged shit show of a son. And Pat thought, "Do it, Lydia. Just do it, please. Do it," he whispered as a tall red bus rumbled past his phone booth, and he held his breath so no more words could escape. And she did it. Lydia took a deep breath. "It's no one, Dee," she said, and she hung up the phone. Chapter 11. Dee of Troy. April 1962. Rome and Porto Vergogna, Italy. Richard Burton was the worst driver Pasquale had ever seen. He squinted in the direction of the road with one eye and held the wheel lightly between two fingers, elbow cocked. With the other hand, he pinched a cigarette out the open window, a cigarette he seemed to have no interest in smoking. From the passenger seat, Pasquale stared at the burning stick in the man's hand, wondering if he should reach over and grab it before the ash got to Richard Burton's fingers. The Alfa's tires chirped and squealed as he cornered his way out of the Roman Centro, some pedestrians yelling and waving their fists as he forced them back onto curbs.
"Sorry," he said, or "so sorry," or "bagger off."
Pasquale hadn't known that Richard Burton was Richard Burton until the woman from the Spanish Steps introduced them. "Pasquale Tursi, this is Richard Burton." Moments before, she had led him away from the steps, still clutching the envelope from Michael Dean, down a couple of streets, up a staircase, through a restaurant and out the back door, until finally they'd come across this man in sunglasses, worsted slacks, a sports coat over a sweater and red scarf, leaning against the light blue Alfa in a narrow alley where there were no other cars. Richard Burton had removed his sunglasses and given a wry smile. He was about Pasquale's height, with thick sideburns, tousled brown hair, and a cleft chin. He had the sharpest features Pasquale had ever seen, as if his face had been sculpted in separate pieces and then assembled on sight. He had faint pockmarks on his cheeks, and a pair of unblinking, wide-set blue eyes. Most of all, he had the biggest head Pasquale had ever encountered. He'd never seen Richard Burton's movies, and knew his name only from the two women on the train the day before. But one look, and there could be no doubt. This man was a cinema star. At the woman's urging, Pasquale explained the whole thing in halting English. Di More coming to his village, waiting there for a mysterious man who didn't come, the doctor's visit and Pasquale's trip to Rome, his mistakenly being sent off with the extras, waiting for Michael Dean, and then the bracing meeting with the man, which began with him punching Dean in the chest, quickly led to Dean admitting that Dee was in fact pregnant and not dying, and ended with the envelope of cash that Dean offered as a payoff, an envelope Pasquale still held in his hand.
"God," Richard Burton finally said. "What a heartless mercenary Dean is. I guess they're getting serious about finishing this bloody picture, sending this shit to handle the budgets, and the gossip, and the rot. Well, he's bollocksed it all up. The poor girl. Listen, Pat."
And he put a hand on Pasquale's arm.
"Take me to her, will you, old sport? So I can at least display a whiff of chivalry amid this fuck-all mess."
"Oh." Pasquale had finally caught up with things, and found himself a bit deflated that this man was his competition, and not the sniveling Michael Dean.
"Then, is your baby?"
Richard Burton had barely flinched.
"It would appear to be the case, yes."
And 20 minutes later, here they were, in Richard Burton's Alfa Romeo, barreling through the outskirts of Rome toward the Autostrada, and eventually, Di More.
"Brilliant to be out driving again."
Richard Burton's hair was rustled by the wind, and he spoke above the road noise. The sun glinted off his dark glasses.
"I tell you, Pat, I envy the punch you landed on Dean. He's a bloody first-flight 10-year-old cocksuck, that one. I'll likely aim a bit higher when it's my go."
The burning cigarette reached Richard Burton's fingers, and he flicked it over the side of his door as if it were a bee that had stung him.
"I trust you know I had nothing to do with sending that girl away. And I certainly didn't know she was with child. Not that I'm thrilled with that part. You know how these on-set things are."
He shrugged and looked out the side window.
"But I like Dee. She's..."
He looked for the word and couldn't find it.
"I've missed her."
He brought his hand to his mouth and seemed surprised there was no cigarette in it.
"Dee and I had a bit of history, and we became friends again when Liz's husband was in town. Then Fox loaned me out to do some bloody stock work on The Longest Day, likely to get rid of me a while. I was in France when Dee got sick. I talked to her by phone, and she said she'd gone to see Dr. Crane, that they'd diagnosed her with cancer. She was going to Switzerland for treatment, but we decided to meet once on the coast. I said I'd finish my work on The Longest Day and meet her in Porto Venere, and I entrusted this blood-blistered Dean to set it up. The blight is a master at insinuating himself. He said she'd taken a bad turn and gone on to burn for treatment, that she would call me when she returned. What could I do?"
"Porto Venere?" Pasquale asked.
Then she had come to his village by mistake.
or because of Michael Dean's deception?
It's this goddamn movie.
Richard Burton shook his head.
It's Satan's asshole, this bloody film. Flash bulbs everywhere. Priests with cameras in their cassocks. Leech fixers coming from the States to keep the girls and booze away. Gossip columns jumping every time we have a bloody cocktail. I should have walked off months ago. It's insanity. And you know why it's gone over this way?
Do you?
Because of her.
Di More?
What?
Richard Burton looked over as if Pasquale hadn't been listening.
Di?
No.
No, because of Liz. It's like having a bloody typhoon in your flat. I didn't come looking for this. Any of it. I was perfectly happy doing Camelot. Not that I could get a bloody handshake from Julie Andrews. Though, trust me, I was not lacking for female companionship. No, I was done with the bloody moron cinema. Back to the stage for me. Regain my promise. The art. All that rot. Then my agent calls. Says Fox will buy me out of Camelot and pay me 4 times my price if I'll roll around Liz Taylor in a robe. 4 times! And I didn't jump right away either. Said I'd think about it. Show me the mortal man who has to think about that. But I did. And do you know what I was thinking?
Pasquale could only shrug. It was like standing in a windstorm listening to this man.
I was thinking about Larry.
Richard Burton looked at Pasquale.
Olivier, lecturing me in that buggering uncle voice of his.
Richard Burton stuck out his lower lip and assumed a nasal voice.
Dick, you will, of course, eventually have to make up your mind whether you wish to be a household word or an actor.
He laughed.
Rotten old sotto. Last night of Camelot, I raised my glass in a toast to Larry and his bloody stage. Said I'd take the money, thank you. And within a week, I'd drive that raven-hair Liz Taylor to her knees, or rather to mine.
He laughed again at the memory.
Olivier. Christ. In the end, really, what does it matter whether some Welsh coal miner's son acts on the stage or the screen? Our names are written water anyway, as Keats said, so what's it bloody matter? Old sots like Olivier and Gielgud can have their code and shove it up each other's arses. Bugger off, boys, and on with the parade, right?
Richard Burton glanced over his shoulder, his hair mixed and blended by the wind through the open convertible.
So I'm off to Rome, where I meet Liz. And let me tell you, Pat, I've never seen a woman like this. I mean, I've had a few in my day, but this one... Christ! Do you know what I said first time I met her?
He didn't wait for Pasquale to answer.
I said, don't know if anyone's ever told you this, but you're not a bad-looking girl.
He smiled.
And when those eyes settle on you, God, the world stops spinning. I knew she was married. More to the point, she's a bloody soul-eater, but I'm not made of steel, either. Of course, any right blighter would choose being a great actor over being a household word if the stacks were the same. That's not really the choice, is it? Because they pile that fuck-all money on the scale, too, and God, man, they put on those tits and that waist, and Christ, those eyes. And the thing begins to tip, old sport. Till the scale goes right over. No, no, we are definitely writ in water. Or cognac, if we've any luck at all.
He winked and swerved, and Pasquale put his hand on the dashboard.
Now, there's an idea. Cognac. Keep an eye out, eh, sport?
He took a deep breath and returned to his story.
Of course the newspapers get hold of Liz and me, and a husband comes to town and I sulked a bit, spent 4 days pissed, and somewhere in there, sotted and sorry, I went back to D again for comfort. Every 2 weeks I'd find myself knocking on her door.
He shook his head.
She's clear, that one. Smart. It's a burden for an attractive woman to be so smart. To see through the curtain? She'd agree with Larry, I'm sure, that I'm wasting my talent making rubbish like this film. And I knew Dee was guns for me. I probably shouldn't have pursued her, but... Who are we but who we are? Am I right?
He patted his chest with his left hand.
You wouldn't happen to have another fag?
Pasquale pulled out a cigarette and lit it for him. Richard Burton took a long drag, and the smoke curled from his nose.
"This Crane, the man who diagnosed Dee, Liz's pill pusher. Man rattles when he walks. He and Dean cooked up this cancer rubbish to get Dee out of town."
He shook his head.
"God damn it. What kind of a hopeless bastard tells a girl with morning sickness that she's dying of cancer?
They'll do anything, these people."
He braked suddenly, and the tires seemed to jump like a scared animal, and the car careened off the road and screeched to a stop at a market on the outskirts of Rome. "You as thirsty as I am, sport?"
"I am hungry," Pasquale said. "I have not eaten."
"Right. Excellent. And you wouldn't have any money, would you? I was so bollocked up when we left, I'm afraid I'm a bit underfunded."
Pasquale opened the envelope and handed him a 1,000 lira note. Richard Burton took the money and ran into the market. He returned a few minutes later with 2 open bottles of red wine, gave one to Pasquale, and settled the other between his legs.
"What goddamn kind of place hasn't got a bottle of cognac in it? Are we to write our names in grape piss, then? Ah, well, in a pinch, I suppose."
He took a long pull of the wine and noticed Pasquale watching him.
"My father was a 12-pint-a-day man. Being Welsh, I've got to keep it in control, so I only drink when I'm working."
He winked.
"Which is why I'm always bloody working."
4 hours later, the man responsible for impregnating Dee Moray had drunk all but a few tugs of both bottles of wine and had stopped for a third. Pasquale couldn't believe how much wine the man could handle. Richard Burton parked the Alfa Romeo near the port in La Spezia, and Pasquale asked around in a harbor bar until a fisherman agreed to take them up the coast to Porto Vergogna for 2,000 lira. The fisherman walked 10 meters ahead of them down to his boat.
"I was born in a tiny village myself,"
Richard Burton told Pasquale, as they settled onto the wooden bench in the stern of the fisherman's dank 10-meter boat. It was a cold, dark evening, and Richard Burton turned up the collar of his jacket against the sharp sea breeze. The boat's captain stood 3 steps above them, the wheel in his hand as he rowed a cross-chop out of the harbor, the froth rising up to the bow, rolling over and then settling back, the salty air making Pasquale even hungrier. The captain ignored them. His ears glowed a cold red in the brisk air. Richard Burton leaned back and sighed.
"The stain I'm from is called Pontrydyfyn. Sits in a little glen between 2 green mountains and is cut by a little river clear as vodka. Little Welsh mining town. And what do you think our river was called?"
Pasquale had no idea what he was talking about.
"Think about it. It'll make perfect sense."
Pasquale shrugged.
"Avon."
He waited for Pasquale to react.
"Fancy a bit of irony, no?"
Pasquale said that it was.
"Right. Okay, then. Did someone mention vodka?" "Right, I did."
Richard Burton sighed wearily. Then he called up to the boat's pilot.
"Are we truly to have nothing to drink on board? Really, Captain?"
The man ignored him.
"He's risking outright mutiny, don't you think, Pat?"
Then Burton leaned back again, resettled his collar against the cool air, and resumed telling Pasquale about the village where he grew up.
"There were 13 of us little Jenkinses, tit-suckers every last one, till the git after me. I was 2 when my poor ma finally gave out, sucks dry. We drained the poor woman like deflating a balloon. I got the last of it. My sister Cecilia raised me after that. The old blighter Jenkins was no help. 50 already when I was born, drunk the minute the sun came up. I barely knew him. His name, the only thing he ever gave me. Burton I got from an acting teacher, though I tell people it's for Michael Burton. Anatomy of Melancholy? No? Right. Sorry."
He ran a hand over his own chest.
"No, this is all a thing I invented. This Burton. Dickie Jenkins is a petty little tit-pincher, but this Richard Burton chap, he bloody well soars."
Pasquale nodded. the chop from the sea and Burton's endless drunk talk conspiring to make him extremely sleepy. Jenkins' boys all worked in the coalface, except me, and I only escaped by luck and Hitler. The RAF was my way out, and though I turned out too bloody blind to fly, it still got me into Oxford. Tell me, do you know what you say to a kid from my village when you see him at Oxford? Pasquale shrugged, worn down by the man's constant chatter. You say, get back to cutting that privet. When Pasquale didn't laugh, Richard Burton leaned in to explain. The point being, not to blow up my own arse, but just so you know, I wasn't always... He looked for the word. This. No, I understand what it is to live in the provinces. Oh, I've forgotten a lot, I'll give you that. Gotten soft. But I have not forgotten that. Pasquale had never encountered someone who talked as much as this Richard Burton. When he didn't understand something in English, Pasquale had learned to change the subject, and he tried this now, in part just to hear his own voice again. Do you play tennis, Richard Burton?
More a rugger by training. I like the rough and tumble. I'd have played club after Oxford, wing forward, if not for the ease with which men in the dramatic arts bunk young women.
He stared off into space.
My brother Ivor, he was a top rugger. I'd have been his equal if I'd stayed at it, although I'd have been limited to the hockey-playing big-breasted girls. From my vantage, the stage jocks got a wider choice.
And then he said to the captain again,
And you're sure you don't have just a nip on board, Captain? No cognac?
When there was no answer, he fell back against the stern again.
Hope this arsehole goes down with his tub.
Finally they rounded the breakwater point, and the icy wind broke as the boat slowed, and they chugged into Porto Vergogna. They bumped against the wooden plug at the end of the pier, seawater lapping over the soggy, sagging boards. In the moonlight, Richard Burton squinted at the dozen or so stone and plaster houses, a couple of them lit by lanterns.
There's the rest of the village over the hill, then.
Pasquale glanced to the top floor of his hotel, where Di More's window was dark. No, is only Porto Vergogna this? Richard Burton shook his head.
Right. Of course it is. My God, it's barely a crack in the cliffs. And no telephones?
No. Pasquale was embarrassed. Next year, maybe they come.
This Dean is fucking mad,
Richard Burton said, with what sounded to Pasquale almost like admiration.
I'm going to flog that little shit until he bleeds from his nipples, bastard.
He stepped onto the dock as Pasquale paid the Spezia fisherman, who shoved off and chugged away without so much as a word. Pasquale started toward the shore. Above them, the fishermen were drinking in the piazza, as if they were eagerly awaiting something. They moved around like bees disturbed from their hive. Now they pushed Tommaso the Communist forward, and he began making his way down the steps to the shore. Even though Pasquale now understood that Di More wasn't dying after all, he felt certain that something terrible had happened to her.
Gualfredo and Pelle came this afternoon in the long boat, Tommaso said when he met them on the steps. They took your American, Pasquale. I tried to stop them. So did your Aunt Valeria. She told them the girl would die if they took her. The American didn't want to go, but that pig Gualfredo told her she was supposed to be in Porto Venere, not here, that a man had come there for her, and she went with them.
Since the exchange was in Italian, the news didn't register with Richard Burton, who lowered the collar of his jacket again, smoothed himself, and glanced up at the small cluster of whitewashed houses. He smiled to Tommaso and said,
I don't suppose you're a bartender, old chap. I could use a shot before telling the poor girl she's been bred.
Pasquale translated what Tommaso had told him.
A man from another hotel has come and take away Di More.
Taken her where?
Pasquale pointed down the coast.
Porto Venere. He say she's supposed to be there, and that my hotel can't take care good of Americans.
That's piracy. We can't allow such a thing to stand, can we?
They walked up to the piazza, and the fishermen shared the rest of their grappa with Richard Burton, while they talked about what to do. There was some talk of waiting until morning, but Pasquale and Richard Burton agreed that Di More must know immediately that she wasn't dying of cancer. They would go to Porto Venere tonight. There was a buzz of excitement among the men on the cold, sea-lapped shore. Tommaso the Elder talked about slitting Gualfredo's throat. Richard Burton asked in English if anyone knew how late the bars were open in Porto Venere. Lugo, the war hero, ran back to his house to get his carbine. Tommaso the Communist raised his hand in a kind of salute and volunteered to pilot the assault on Gualfredo's hotel. And it was around this time Pasquale realized that he was the only sober man in Porto Vergogna. He walked to the hotel and went inside to tell his mother and his Aunt Valeria that they were going down the coast and to grab a bottle of port for Richard Burton. His aunt was watching from her window and describing what she saw to Pasquale's mother, who was propped up in bed. Pasquale stuck his head in the doorway.
"I tried to stop them," Valeria said.
She looked grim. She handed Pasquale a note.
"I know,"
Pasquale said as he read the note. It was from Di More.
"Pasquale, some men came to tell me that my friend was waiting for me in Porto Venere, and that there had been a mistake. I will make sure you get paid for your trouble. Thank you for everything. Yours, D."
Pasquale sighed. "Yours."
"Be careful," his mother said from her bed. "Gualfredo is a hard man."
He put the note in his pocket.
"I'll be fine, mamma."
"Yes, you will be, Pasco," she said. "You are a good man."
Pasquale wasn't used to this outward affection, especially when his mother was in one of her dark moods. Maybe she was coming out of it. He walked into the room and bent over to kiss her. She had the stale smell she so often got when confined to her bed. But before he could kiss her, she reached out with a clawed hand and squeezed his arm as tightly as she could, her arm shaking. Pasquale looked down at her shaking hand.
"Mamma, I'm coming right back."
He looked at his Aunt Valeria for help, but she wouldn't look up, and his mother wouldn't let go of his arm.
"Mamma, it's okay."
"I told Valeria that such a tall American girl would never stay here. I told her that she would leave."
"Mamma, what are you talking about?"
She leaned back and slowly let go of his arm.
"Go get that American girl and marry her, Pasquale. You have my blessing."
He laughed and kissed her again.
"I'll go find her, but I love you, mamma, only you. There's no one else for me."
Outside, Pasquale found Richard Burton and the fishermen still drinking in the piazza. An embarrassed Lugo said they couldn't borrow his carbine after all, because his wife was using it to stake some tomato plants in their cliffside garden. As they walked down toward the shore, Richard Burton nudged Pasquale and pointed to the Hotel Adequate View sign.
"Yours?"
Pasquale nodded.
"My father's."
Richard Burton yawned.
"Bloody brilliant."
Then he happily took the bottle of port.
"I tell you, Pat, this is one damn strange picture."
The fisherman helped Tommaso the Communist dump his nets and gear and a sleeping cat into the piazza, and they used the cart to wheel his outboard motor down to the water. Pasquale and Richard Burton climbed in. The fishermen stood watching from what was left of Pasquale's beach. Tommaso's first yank on the pull start knocked the bottle of port from Richard Burton's hand. But luckily it landed in Pasquale's lap without spilling much. He handed it back to the drunk Welshman. But the little motor refused to catch. They sat, rocking in the waves, drifting slowly away, Richard Burton suppressing little belches and apologizing for each one.
"Air's a bit stagnant on this yacht," he said.
"Bastard!"
Tommaso yelled to the engine. He beat on it and pulled again. Nothing. The other fishermen yelled that it either wasn't getting spark or wasn't getting fuel, than those who'd said spark switched to fuel and fuel to spark. Something came over Richard Burton then, and he stood, and in a deep, resonant voice, addressed the three old fishermen, yelling from the shore, "Fear not, Achaean brothers, I swear to you, tonight there will be the weeping of soft tears in Porto Venere, tears for want of their dead sons, upon whom we now go to wage war, for the sake of fair Dee, that woman who so makes the blood run. I give you my word as a gentleman, as an Achaean, we shall return victorious, or not at all." And while they didn't understand a word of the speech, the fishermen could tell it was epic, and they all cheered, even Lugo, who was pissing on the rocks. Then Richard Burton waved his bottle over his two crewmates, in a sort of benediction. Pasquale huddled against the cold in the back of the boat, and Tommaso the Communist was adjusting the choke on the motor. "Oh, you lost sons of Porto Venere, prepare to meet the shock of doom borne down upon you by this fearless army of good men." He put his hand on Pasquale's head. "Achilles here, and the smelly bloke pulling on the motor, I forget his name. Fair men all, pitiless and powerful, and—" Tommaso pulled, the motor caught, and Richard Burton nearly fell out. But Pasquale caught him and sat him down in the boat. Burton patted Pasquale on the arm and slurred, "More than kin and less than kind." They chugged away into the grain of the chop. Finally, the rescue party was away. On shore, the fishermen were drifting away to their beds. In the boat, Richard Burton sighed. He took a swig and looked once more at the little town disappearing behind the rock wall, as if it had never existed at all. "Listen, Pat," Richard Burton said. "I take back what I said about being from a small village like yours." He gestured with a bottle of port. "Now I'm sure it's a fine place, but Christ, man, I've left bigger settlements in my rank trousers." They walked ashore and straight into Gualfredo's recently remodeled albergo, the Hotel de la Mar in Porto Venere. The desk clerk required even more of the money from Pasquale's payoff from Michael Dean, but after they'd negotiated his outrageous price, the man gave them the bottle of cognac that Richard Burton wanted and the number of Dee Morey's room. The actor had slept a little in the boat, Pasquale had no idea how, and now he swirled the cognac like mouthwash, swallowed, patted down his hair, and said, "Okay, good as gold." He and Pasquale climbed the stairs and walked down the hallway to the tall door of Dee's room, Pasquale looking around at Gualfredo's modern hotel and becoming embarrassed again that Dee Morey had ever stayed in his grubby little pensione. The smell of this place, clean and something he thought of as vaguely American, made him realize how badly the adequate view must stink. The old women and rotting damp sea smell of the place. Richard Burton walked in front of Pasquale, weaving on the carpet, righting the ship with each step. He patted down his hair, winked at Pasquale, and rapped lightly with one knuckle on the hotel room door. When there was no answer, he knocked louder. "Who is it?" Dee Morey's voice came from behind the door.
"Ah, it's Richard, love," he said. "Come to rescue you."
A moment later, the door flew open, and Dee appeared in a robe. They crashed into each other's arms, and Pasquale had to look away, or risk betraying his deep envy and embarrassment that he'd ever imagined that she could want to be with someone like him. He was a donkey, watching two thoroughbreds prance in a field. After a few seconds, Dee Morey pushed Richard Burton away. In a voice both chiding and sweet, she asked him, "Where have you been?"
"I was looking for you," Richard Burton said. "It's been something of an odyssey. But listen, there's something I need to tell you. I'm afraid we've been the subjects of a frightful bit of deception here."
"What are you talking about?"
"Come in, sit down. I'll explain the whole thing." Richard Burton helped her back into her room, and the door closed behind them.
Pasquale stood alone in the hallway then, staring at the door, unsure what to do, listening to the hushed conversation inside, and trying to decide whether he should simply stand there, or knock on the door and remind them that he was out here, or just go back down to the boat.